In this brief life of 80 years, you have set before you the choice. Once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide in the strife twixt truth and falsehood for the good or evil side. Then it is the brave man chooses while the coward stands aside. Ugh, see, he hasn't made that choice and you don't know how to make it. The suspense of that is a great dramatic moment. But the Hindu has that funny look, which says, huh? Well, now, we've got to get to the bottom of this. And I'm a little diffident about this because I don't want to insult anyone's intelligence. But I do want to give you what should be called the first lesson. What your mother should have told you before you learned about 1, 2, 3 and ABC. There is something underneath all that. There's something much deeper. And it's, of course, about black and white. But now let me introduce it by asking you to consider all your senses as forms of one sense. Basically a sort of sense of touch. Because seeing is touching at a distance. Our eyes are so sensitive that they can touch light. Our ears are so sensitive that they can touch vibrations of air. Our fingertips are less sensitive. In Western civilization, our noses are almost insensitive. But these are all forms of response to touch, whether they be rather solid things like tables and rocks, or whether they be very subtle things like tiny particles in the air or light waves. So when your senses are touched, they go off and on. Either there's something there or there isn't. Now, when you consider, for example, the phenomenon of sound, there isn't actually such a thing as pure sound. When you hear a sound, a note being sung, you are actually hearing a vibration. You are hearing sound silence, oscillating. Because it is the alternation of sound and silence that impresses us. This is so with almost all contacts. If you have a delightful girl sitting next to you, and you want to make your presence known to her, and you put your hand on her knee, and you leave it there, she will cease to notice it. But if you gently pat her on the knee, she'll know you're still there. Because you come and you go. Now you see it, now you don't. So all physical... all physical manifestations are in the sense vibratory. They are pulses. Light is a pulse. And the most solid rock is also a pulse. And you can't put your finger through it for the same reason that you can't put your finger through an electric fan when it's revolving. It's going too fast. So this table is going so fast that I can't... Darn it, philosophers are always using tables to illustrate something because they speak in classrooms. Gets a little boring. But still, it resists because it's going so fast. On, off, on, off, on, off, on, off, on, off. So you see, this is the process, the nature of a wave. You can't have, there is not such a thing in nature as half a wave. A wave, that is to say, which has only a crest and no trough. To get a wave, you have to have a crest and a trough at the very least. So the up and the down go together. Likewise, therefore, the black and the white. So what we call existence is being, non-being. So therefore, to be or not to be is not the question. To be and not to be are inseparable companions. Just like Tweedledum and Tweedledee. who incidentally agreed to have a battle. So between all these explicit differences, like the top and the bottom, the up and the down, the front and the back, the light and the dark, explicit differences have behind them an implicit unity. That is to say, they are always found together. There is, as it were, a conspiracy under the surface to look as different as possible and yet to be one. It takes one to produce difference. Because you see, you don't know what you mean by difference unless you know what you mean by unity. You don't know what you mean by is unless you know what you mean by isn't. You know, there is a match booklet in this hand, and there isn't one in this hand. Abstract from that, and you get the idea of being and non-being. But they go together. Now, the whole joke that's been played on you, by you, of course, is that they don't go together. That, in other words, black might win. That seems very persuasive. After all, when one looks at existence, you realize it's quite an effort. A lot of energy going on. Wouldn't it have been so much easier for there not to have been anything at all? Once you get that idea, existence becomes odd. And so also when you think about death, what would it be like to go to sleep and never wake up? That thought always makes us intellectually dizzy. And it makes you think about birth. The funny event of waking up after never having gone to sleep. And there's something distinctly spooky about that. But, you see, this is all part of it. That the black side has to be real genuine black, so that the white side can be real genuine white. And it must always seem as if whenever black turns up, that's going to be the end. And this is the conspiracy. So when you've got the game, uh-oh, black might win, you have to play the next game, which is, uh-oh, white must win. And so we start it all out, the battle between the sides. And from this battle come all the complexities of human culture, just out of black and white. Look how complicated we can make them. The game of heads and tails is one of the very simplest forms. Will it be heads? Will it be tails? That gets boring. We make it more complicated. We make them into dice. We make them into checkers. More complicated still, chess. That's all based on black and white. But how elegant. Even color emerges finally from black and white. Analyze our composite structure down to its final terms, and we seem to turn up to be something like a newspaper photograph. You know, black and white dots that stand away from them, and they seem to be light and shadow. The pointillist painters saw this. That we are all this buzzing little on-off, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. Every neuron is either firing or not firing, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And out of this multiplicity of yes and no comes, whew, look at this thing. But it all depends on this little joke, see? That we forget, somehow, that yes and no go together. A person who understands that, you see, is a sort of initiate. He's been let in behind the scenes. He's what you would call a person who's very far in. There are a lot of, most of us are very far out. Actually, the person you might call a square is the most far out person there is. Because he really believes that black might win, that white must win. He's completely bamboozled. He's altogether forgotten the secret. So he's way, way out, lost as lost can get. But how brave, how magnificent. But so that he doesn't go off his head altogether, there are always in society some far-in people. And they're what are called the esoteric people, as compared with the exoteric people. And the far-in people are rather cagey. They don't give the show away too easily. Now you might say, you're not being very far in. You're explaining to us what the joke is. And you really shouldn't do that, because if we knew that it was all right and that the whole thing was a joke, what would happen to our incentives? Now I feel I can say all this quite safely, because very few people will believe it. Because it's very difficult to believe. The other position, that black might win, is marvelously persuasive. So maybe in this audience there might be a few people who would understand, and then our anxiety is, will such people stop the show? Will they suddenly become inert, be enemies of progress, or become, frankly, immoral because, you know, you want to obliterate someone, and after all, they're not serious, they're just a mask of God, which is the same as you are, you can just push them out of the way, it doesn't matter. Will they get like that? Well, there's always a gamble, you see. The whole thing is a gamble. And there's always danger. Every good thing in this world is dangerous. The moment you teach a child how to walk, you give it the capacity to kick its mother. The moment you have fire to warm yourself and to cook with, you have the possibility of destruction. There is no way around danger. So, of course, a person who was in the highest sense of the word disenchanted, you see, that it's a marvelous word, because it has a positive meaning as well as the usual negative one. To be enchanted is to be spellbound, to be fascinated, like a chicken with its nose on a chalk line. So the actor who is really involved in playing the world is fascinated. He's enchanted by his own spell. Spell, in the beginning was the word. Do you see? The chant. So to be disenchanted is to suddenly recover from a state of auto-hypnosis, to wake up. That's why a Buddha means, from the Sanskrit word Buddha, to waken, to be awakened. A Buddha is one who has woken up and who knows, my goodness, it's all a dream. But what a magnificent dream. Beautiful, see? A great work of art. Art in the highest sense. Maya, as the Hindus call the world, as well as Leela. Maya means, very roughly, illusion. But it means a lot more besides. It means magic. It means art. It means creative power. It means construction. From a root word, mater, to lay down the foundations of a building. Hence our word, meter. Measure. Metric. And also matter. Does it matter? Means, does it put on a good show? Does it amount to something? Is it a convincing illusion? Illusion, likewise, connected with the Latin ludere, to play. But you see, we have a culture in which words like play, illusion, and so on, have a bad connotation. We don't want to get with an illusion. And we want in the end to know, I wonder if we really do want this, that at least God is serious. Now look, if I say to you, I love you, and supposing I say this in a very personal way to a particular individual, the person I say that to turns around to me and says, are you serious? I say, no. No, indeed. but I am sincere. This is a commitment. It's a rash commitment. It's the height of rashness. But it's therefore not serious. Keiseling, in his South American Meditations, makes the point that a man of spirit is above all a man lacking in seriousness. He, as a man of courage, plays with his life. And to quote G.K. Chesterton again, he said, "The angels fly because they take themselves lightly." How much more so, then, the Lord of the angels? I mean, just let me put this in anthropomorphic terms, because there's an important thing about talking about God in anthropomorphic terms. A, nobody takes it too seriously. B, it puts things vividly in ways that escape more abstract intellectual language. I mean, when all those angels and saints are around the throne of God in heaven forever and ever, what sort of a show do you want to be going on? Is everybody going to look at each other and weep? Are they going to stare into the eye of the Lord and say, yeah. Dante, in the Paradiso, describes the hymn of the angels, and he says it is like the laughter of the universe. In other words, they sing, "Alleluia, alleluia, alleluia." And what the devil does that mean? It doesn't mean anything, except it's a kind of celestial whoopee. So you see, what I'm pointing out is this, that even in the tradition of the most serious religion that there is, the one that really takes life seriously, because there's the possibility of ultimate tragedy, even in this most serious religion, its mythological forms, its symbology, gives a little tweak to give away the show. Just as in those Hindu images of Shiva, the destroyer aspect of the divinity, when he's dancing the Tandava, the dance that he dances at the end of the cycle, when the whole universe is destroyed. He's shown with 10 arms and fierce aspect, and in his 9 of his arms, he has bells and thunderbolts and clubs and knives, but one arm is in this gesture. The hand, palm outwards, fingers up. It means, don't be afraid. This is a big act. So you see, the notion of the world as playful is, I think you may agree, the only finally workable and rational solution to our predicament. There is always, of course, the chance that it might not be. There is indeed the chance that you may wake up to find yourself everlastingly damned, or that you may never wake up at all. I don't know what that would mean, except nobody would ever know whether it was serious or wasn't. But it seems to me that there are certain metaphysical systems, some of which are good gambles and some of which are not. Because a great deal of the problems of life resolve themselves to the question, what are good game rules? Ethical questions have to be decided this way, aesthetic questions, and questions of simple political organization. Now, you can obviously see, can't you, that a social order in which nobody trusts anybody else is not set up as a going game. If everybody is spying on his next door neighbor, and if we have a big brother who's got a kind of television outlet and a mic in every room, everybody's bugged. And that's no game, because the poor old big brother can't even take a walk in the park, because he's got to sit there watching everybody. The Hindus worked this out in a book called the Arthashastra, where It is a manual of operations for the perfect tyrant. And it gives minute instructions how to hedge himself in with rings like the rings of a spider's web. How he gets the different ranks of his courtiers and advisors. He puts them all at enmity with each other so that they will all spy on each other and all report on each other. And then right in the center, he lives in the super-protected room where he has guards, but other guards watching those guards. And he has a secret exit out from the middle that goes somewhere down to the river where he's got a fast speedboat waiting. And on the way out, there's a keystone he can pull and make the whole palace collapse. Now here is a man living in perpetual paranoia. He can't even sleep. He has to have some varlet taste his food for him to be sure it isn't poisoned. He's the maximum non-trust. And this is a non-workable system. You cannot throw a ball unless you're willing to let go of it. So in exactly this way, game rules have to have play in them. That is to say, they have to be a good game, has to involve a wonderful balance of chance and skill, randomness and order. Then it has a chance of going on. I was discussing tossing a coin. That's a very boring game. Tic-tac-toe is a pretty boring game, because if you know how to play it, anyone who starts wins. So it reduces itself to tossing coins. On the other extreme, three-dimensional chess is much too complicated for most people to keep track of. And they lose themselves in the tangles of it. But somehow in the middle, games like poker, bridge, chess, even Go, marvelously intriguing, people can get fascinated with them. You know how it is, once you become a chess buff, you can't let go. You go on and on and on and on. Well, that's what we call the instinct for survival. You know, the moth game, the bee game, the bird game, the man game, you can't let go, it's fascinating. So we're all human buffs. A universe that mans, or that peoples, just as an apple tree apples. And the apple tree apple serves to go on appling, because appling is great. So is treeing. But you can see different forms of trees and different forms of animals in the same way as you get the difference between mazurka, waltz, Charleston, twist, rumba, or sonata, fugue, partita, or mahjong, chess, dominoes. It's all like that. The question is to find out the most fascinating thing. See, if you play chess, which can become a game of pure skill, with the element of chance almost eliminated when a real champion is concerned, it ceases to be fun after a while, unless you have an opponent who is a little bit unpredictable. The whole point of it is that you cannot quite figure out the other person's skill. And that introduces an element of chance. But if a game is pure chance, the fun goes out of it, unless you're out of your mind and think that there is a serious chance you might win. So it's in looking for that strange balance that we find a clue to what it's all about. The question is simply, fundamentally, do you have the nerve to follow that through? Can you look black, night, death, in the face and say, well, I really do know you're the other side of white. You come on pretty fierce, but that's your nature. And that anxiety, which constantly asks the question to be or not to be, and therefore trembles between them, will in the end turn into laughter, the same trembling. But it knows that to be and not to be are inseparable twins.